Well, next on The Old Mole, we have Bill Resnick interviewing David Courtwright, who is a Vietnam War veteran and a warrior for peace. David wrote the classic book Soldiers in Revolt, and they'll talk about recent use of the U.S. military and the hope for both defunding police and transforming the military into something other than it is today. Bill?
Hi, David Courtwright. Welcome to KABU.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
David Courtwright taught peace studies and nonviolent social change at Notre Dame University for over 30 years. He's written or edited over 20 books. Wrote his first book just after a tour of duty in the Vietnam War, titled Soldiers in Revolt. It's a classic on the organizing and achievements of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, especially those who revolted while serving. Later became the chair of the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and all the while remained an activist teacher, for example, opposing the Iraq and Afghan wars, writing and advocating for a peaceful resolution in those countries. His latest book, co-authored, is Governance for Peace. We'll be discussing Trump's ordering the U.S. military into U.S. cities on June 1st, including Portland, in Trump's language, to dominate the streets and clear out the George Floyd insurgency demonstrators that he described as looters, vandals, terrorists. The big issue, what can be done to stop Trump from going from this dress rehearsal, should he be losing the November election, to create chaos, calling out his fanatic followers and the Second Amendment people into the streets, and then, of course, to declare martial law. The issue today is how to make sure the military refuse to obey illegal orders, which in the final analysis depends on whether we, the people, organize to oppose Trump military rule and to influence the politicians and the military. Tell Trump that they cannot and will not order the troops out. Tell him that this defies the tradition and the Constitution. So first, David Courtwright, tell us about Trump's action on June 1st. What happened on the ground, and then the response from the politics and the press, but especially the response by General James Mattis, revered military figure, somewhat controversial. Tell us about his rebuke of Trump. Was he heard by the military?
Sure.
Did they listen? Did they discuss it? Is there any chance they will disobey Trump and just not act?
Well, it's an important question you're posing, and it's clear that Trump is less and less popular. He's losing political support. He's trying to grasp to the military and to portray himself as a friend of the military and use that as a way to bolster his standing and possibly try to use the military to prevent him being removed from office. His action there in early June, the stunt that he pulled in Washington in front of the White House. One was to basically clear peaceful protesters, lawful right of Senate, protest in front of the White House. National Guard troops and others forced off the streets, a really unprecedented move. And then takes this walk across to this church right across the street and brings with him General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary of Defense Esper, really showing the military. It's a kind of show of force by the president to all of us to say, I've got the military guys on my side, don't mess with me. The use of the military and National Guard troops in the streets is bad enough, although, of course, that's happened often in our history, especially against folks in African-American communities in terms of responding to uprisings against racial abuse. In this case, that was combined with this gesture of trying to use the military as a power play. But really something quite extraordinary happened in terms of the pushback from senior ranks of the military against what Trump was trying to do. And I think what happened was really unprecedented in recent U.S. military history. Never have we seen so many senior military commanders push back and rebuke the presumed commander-in-chief. And as you say, one of the leading figures in this pushback was General James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, former four-star Marine Corps general and former Secretary of Defense. And he really strongly denounced Trump in an interview in Atlantic Magazine. Similar renunciations of Trump's the use of the military against civilian protesters by other former senior military chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they were Mike Mullen, Mike General Dempsey, Marine Corps Gerald Giles. You also had Colin Powell, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and many other military and senior defense and department officials. And Trump tried to double down on his use of the military, so he gave the commencement address the following weekend at West Point, and he was greeted by an open letter condemning the, quote, politicization of the armed forces, unquote, that was signed by hundreds of former West Point graduates. So I think that's very significant. And it was not just the top general. There were also senior enlisted officials who spoke out. One of them was the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, Kelly Wright. He's an African-American. He said he was outraged about the president's response and the nation's response to the killing of George Floyd. Amazingly, he said, "I am George Floyd. I am Philando Castile. I am Michael Brown, etc." And then we also heard there were some articles that some members of the National Guard who were called out, who were in the streets, you know, with their rifles pointed at the crowds, some of them took a knee in the gesture of solidarity and support for those who have been killed by police and racial violence, racial abuse. This has really become a hot issue in the military. It's especially significant because a growing number of people in the military are people of color. The latest figures I saw is that more than 40% of the male enlistees in the military are persons of color, and female enlistees, it's a smaller part of the military, but among female enlistees, more than 56% are people of color. So the question of racial justice is directly relevant to many of the people who are in the military itself. And I think there's a couple lessons here. One is we can't assume that the military will automatically be in lockstep with a president obviously bigoted and is using the military in a politicized way that's completely against the principles of the American Constitution. And so that's a sign of hope. And the other is that we as a movement, those of us who are protesting and going out to these marches, and we need to continue demonstrating and demanding for racial justice and stating over and over that Black Lives Matter, we need to understand that the people in the military are not our enemies. Even encourage folks in the military to support the movement. I can speak from my personal experience during the Vietnam days, very much part of the movement, even though I was inside the military. And there were many of us inside the military who, you know, we put on a form and had to do our job for the military. And every chance we had, we would go to peace rally ourselves and be supportive of the movement. And that was partly because people in the movement understood that full veterans were becoming more and more opposed to the war. And we were welcomed, we were supported. That made a huge difference in building the overall anti-war movement. When people began to see that even active duty soldiers and recent combat veterans were marching against her, that gave us a lot of public support, a lot of legitimacy, and strengthened our efforts to try to finally end the Vietnam War.
This is Bill Resnick talking to David Courtwright, who wrote the book Soldiers in Revolt. He's done 22 books, co-edited them. He's become a peace and nonviolence activist. We'll talk about nonviolence resistance coming to the end of the interview. David, there are still veterans groups, especially Veterans for Peace, that I know about fairly well, but there are many others who are trying to organize not just veterans, but going to the soldiers themselves. The soldiers themselves come from families all over the United States, although mostly in rural areas. But there has been so much pushback against the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. People sort of understand that the military has been ordered into sacrificing all sorts of lives for very dubious ends. Tell us about the effort to organize the military right now. I'm afraid that unlike in Vietnam, when they were drafted, they were civilian army mostly. This army is an army of volunteers. It's going to be a little harder to get to them, especially in the near term, because the Vietnam War struggles went on and on, and it was a very long war, and it became increasingly clear that it was not only unwinnable but unjust, and that radiated out to the military. Today we don't have that much time, it seems to me, to get to the soldiers themselves. But tell us about the efforts to do that by Veterans for Peace and many other groups.
Well, as you mentioned, there are groups of veterans who are actively reaching out to their colleagues in the military. The most important one is Veterans for Peace, been organizing for a number of decades now, includes veterans from the Vietnam era right through to the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and have been trying to reach out to troops at different bases. And then there's the group called About Face, which used to be Iraq Veterans Against the War. And that's obviously the veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan war who have been quite active. And so there is a base already to begin to work with current military. And I think it's important for us to understand that while it is true, it's difficult now for people in the military to speak out because they volunteer, they sign up. But people join the military because they are extremists in some way. Mostly they're joining the military because they need educational benefits. They need opportunity. They need employment. I like to say that there's no military draft, but there is a kind of an economic draft, an economic conscription. We need to be mindful that some of those troops are allies, many of them be people of color, and let's reach out to them and try to build between the social racial justice and the military would naturally support us.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to David Courtright, who's been a longtime peace activist, nonviolent activist, served in Vietnam, wrote the classic book Soldiers in Revolt. We've been discussing the possibilities of parts of the upper reaches, retired though, of the military, but some who are on active duty now have apparently, particularly people of color, rebuked the president and sent him a signal that if they try to use the military to suppress resistance, if he declares martial law while losing the election, he would first create chaos in the street by calling out his fanatical supporters and his First and his Second Amendment friends. But if he tries that, it seems he's likely to get more than he bargained for, and he's being threatened by that. Could well be that he will think again, although, of course, Trump, if he's not president, he faces numerous investigations of his very unethical and sometimes criminal conduct as a businessman, no doubt about taxes. In any event, David, it seems to me, in the final analysis, it's the people of the United States who are influencing the politicians. If the people organize, if there's really a recognition that Trump is extremely dangerous and threatens even the limited constitutional freedoms that many of us enjoy and a lot of them don't, if the people organize and are ready in the cities to protest and do general strikes, if that's discussed, it seems to me that that would also reverberate into the military and show that there's popular support for the resistance in the military. It seems to me that's really important. Tell us about that kind of nonviolent resistance that's necessary.
Yes, well, the movement that we're seeing today is historic. There are studies indicating that the movement for racial justice today, the Black Lives Matter movement that has emerged, especially after the killing of George Floyd, is the largest and most diverse movement we've ever seen. And I remember back from the 60s and all through the recent decades, people always said that what we really need in America to achieve progress is a broadly diverse, genuine rainbow movement in which concerned people of all races, of white, blacks, browns, and all of us, join together to demand justice. Today we're seeing that. The crowds that have turned out in these racial justice movements are filled with people, lots of white folks of good conscience who want to support the demands of our black brothers and sisters. And so we've already achieved tremendous progress. We have a movement of mass participation that is broadly intersectional and diverse, and so we've or that we may take a long step towards being ready to bring about fundamental change in this country. The key now, I think, is to two things. First is persistence, that these movements have to continue. A couple of weeks of protests in June is not going to bring about the necessary changes in America. We have to keep protesting for months, years. The Vietnam anti-war movement went on for 10 years before we finally ended that terrible conflict. Many of the great movements for fundamental change in American life have taken years. So we need to keep up the pressure. The second challenge is equally large and in some ways maybe even more difficult, which is how do we turn all of this energy in the streets into substantive public change? I know there are some people saying, well, it's a revolution. We're going to overthrow the system and, you know, hopefully can overthrow and change fundamentally the system. But change happens through specific steps, and we have to figure out what are the actions that we need to see in all of our institutions in society. 18,000 local police departments in America, every one of them needs change. You know, we say defund the police. Well, to me that means let's take the money that we're now spending on the police and devote more to other forms of enhancing public safety and security in our communities, you know, dealing with family dispute problems, dealing with mental health problems, helping with economic opportunity and social equality in our communities. These are all part of the equation of addressing the problem of abusive, racialized policing in America. So demands are out on the street now. The difficult part is to turn it into policy. I mean, even in Minneapolis, the city council, I believe, adopted a resolution calling for defunding the police, but, you know, they've not been able to turn it into concrete results yet. I'm sure they're continuing. It'll be an ongoing struggle. But it illustrates that just calling for defunding for a radical change in the police is not by itself enough to bring about the change. We have to figure out strategies and bring in a broad coalition, figure out what are the most fundamental changes that we need in the policing of our communities and what are the functions that are not being met right now in terms of addressing social needs in families and in communities, in neglected communities. Focus our attention on that and get concrete policy proposals that will shift resources from militarized police to greater support for community development, for addressing family and social needs in our communities.
Right, and would you see extending that analysis to the military as well? We have an enormously bloated military. We're spending trillions, actually, on over time on nuclear weapons and more surveillance systems and this entire apparatus of military equipment and training and warships and planes to be able to supply power to control the world, in addition, of course, trying to colonize space for military purposes. It seems to me there's a lot of room, and what has to happen is a tremendous change of first defunding of the military, replacement of some of its functions by various kinds of care and cooperative, people-led services, particularly emergency services for saving people as this climate change gets more severe and dangerous. What do you see as the future of the Army?
There are direct parallels between the fundamental changes that we need in policing and so-called security in our own communities here at home and the way in which our military has been engaged in all of these unnecessary wars and aggressive actions and interventions in countries all over the world. And there has been substantial debate, even within the military and among many of us in the policy research community, to try to define a different kind of U.S. international policy. We don't need all of these aircraft carriers and nuclear weapons and all these excessive weapons programs. We could have a much smaller military to actually defend our country and use the resources that we waste on these weapons instead for programs that we know will help to create a safer and more secure world. Most importantly is economic development and humanitarian assistance. many problems that require greater resources. Also, additional increase of armed violence and of extremism and terrorism. Instead of using military means, we should be focusing on social program development. And, of course, a much greater focus on diplomacy and trying to negotiate with other countries to build partnerships, support the United Nations, support other international institutions to address the challenges that exist around the world. And one of the most dangerous policies internationally now, in my opinion, is this militarized confrontation with China. Those who are in the Navy know full well that a big part of the U.S. Navy now is focused on the West Pacific. And we have, I believe, two aircraft carrier groups patrolling in waters close to the Chinese coast in this show of force, somehow intimidate the Chinese into following the diktats coming from the White House. And, of course, it's complete folly. There's no chance that China is going to be intimidated by us in their own backyard, and it's extremely dangerous. All of that is completely unnecessary, counterproductive. We have differences with China, but we could figure out ways to cooperate. The answer is to find diplomatic ways of addressing our differences and cooperating where we need to on global problems. Just to stay on the China theme, we're dealing now with this horrific pandemic, public health crisis across the entire planet. And our country, unfortunately, has done probably one of the worst jobs. And China is where perhaps it seems to have started, but where they've really done a great job in solving the problem and have so far contained the disease. We can learn a lot by cooperating with Chinese and by cooperating with other Eastern states that are much more successful than we have been in addressing the pandemic. Instead, the president is trying to go it alone and cutting off cooperation with countries, cutting off the opportunity for Chinese scientists and students to come to our country, and not just from China. Cooperation is what we need with the rest of the world. Diplomacy to address our differences through negotiation and conversation rather than threats and bluster. So I see it as parallel to what we need to do here, because we have that same mentality from our policing. What's the answer to these problems? Give them more military equipment, use force constantly, excessively against unarmed civilians, especially against people of color. And it's counterproductive. It's causing greater insecurity in our communities. We need to end racialized policing and create new forms of public safety and security, genuine security for our communities that don't rely on heavily armed, abusive police forces.
David Courtwright, thanks a lot for your work. Thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, well, thanks. Great to be able to talk with you. And we hope all our listeners are going to stay involved, keep supporting the racial justice movement, Black Lives Matter, but also get to work on the specific policy changes that we need here at home to ensure that the policing departments are structurally changed, the funds are used instead for supporting community action to address our social needs and community needs. We'll continue to march for justice.
Yeah, I'll be there. David, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, so long.
Thank you.